You're listening to the World Soccer Talk podcast, the only podcast about watching soccer on TV and online. Welcome to episode 167. Coming up on this week's show, we have live soccer on television, news about NBC starting talks with the Premier League about renewing the TV rights deal, our take on Grant Wall getting fired by Sports Illustrated, is this the end of the International Champions Cup? Plus, we have letters from you, the listeners, in our mailbag section. I'm Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined alongside Kartik Krishna, my co-host. Kartik, let's start off, if you don't mind, with Sunderland Till I Die. So, season two, both of us have now watched that on Netflix. Season one, I think you would agree, is probably one of the best soccer documentaries, especially in the last 5 years. What I would say about season two, though, Kartik, is that while I enjoyed it, and I thoroughly recommend that listeners and obviously viewers watch it, I think it's one of those things where maybe they had a little bit of closer rein on the production or didn't let the cameras go into certain places. But this is a better feel, a better look at Sunderland FC, and not so much dirt or grime on this one, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Chris. I mean, I thought that it was, unfortunately, and these documentaries generally don't have season twos, right? I don't remember a club one that has in a while. So this was actually encouraging that there was a season two, but it looked like what happened is when you go from Ellis Short's ownership, absentee ownership, he's sitting in Florida running Sunderland, but pumping as much money, and I think that comes out in the first episode, right? First or second episode when Stuart Donald and his financial staff are looking at it, looking at the book, saying, okay, well, we had an owner that was willing to put any amount of money in to sustain losses. I'm not willing to do that. But when you had that kind of loose control of Sunderland, it was up to the club staff to make a determination about how the flow of the documentary in season one. And we got this no holes barred look, which even included looking at the players like the Aidan McGeady's and the Jack Rodwells, the guys who had at one time been stars or at least very promising players, and how they handled the relegation and cut in wages, wanting to be transferred, etc. What we got in season two was more propaganda-ish view from the club. I liked some of the interactions with club staff, which I always like in these documentaries, and love that in the that's probably the best aspect of the Goalhanger films that Gary Lineker did that we saw aired in this country on NBC, the Watford and Crystal Palace and West Brom documentaries, was the talk with club staff. There's a big emphasis on fans. I kind of love but hate how the league trophy. I can't even remember who the sponsor is now. Check Trade, right? Yeah. How they when they're playing the Newcastle U21s at the Stadium of Light, they make it look like they're playing Newcastle, right? Because it's such a big derby, yep. And you have the Newcastle crest, etc. Although the crowd that night kind of reflected the cup, right? It was a smallish crowd. But my biggest takeaway from this is that all of the things that we've heard from Sunderland fans that began to get muted as Phil Parkinson came in December of this season, which would be the next season, right? But the season that currently is suspended, and turned the club around quickly. It has the club now in a position where they may get automatic promotion. If they don't, they're the favorites to come up via the playoffs. But prior to that, there was a lot of complaints about Stuart Donald from Sunderland fans. Sunderland fans wanted Ellis Short out of the club, as you saw at the very end of season one, and then was played again as they did the intro to season two. You know, get out of our club. You heard the Mackens chanting and screaming. But then what I've heard from Sunderland fans and listened on podcasts, you know, Jonathan Wilson and Barry Glendening are two very prominent Sunderland fans in the UK media, is that Stuart Donald is this real spendthrift. He doesn't want to spend money on anything and is afraid to fund losses. So sometimes you hear fans and media say that about an owner, and it's like, okay, that's just a very convenient narrative. You see it in the boardroom, run in this documentary. You see, that's absolutely the case. He does not, and granted, they've been relegated to League One, but he does not want to invest or spend the kind of money that Ellis Short did. And Ellis Short's money sustained, for all the critiques of him, sustained Premier League status for 10 years for a club that probably should not have been in the top flight for 10 years. Let's be honest about it, okay, given their history, given their up and down history, never mind the size of their supporter space, and never mind that great night in 1973 when they beat Leeds United in the FA Cup final. They're a club that has been a yo-yo club historically for the last 40 years, and suddenly they had a decade of top flight football sustained by an owner that was offshore, and that the fans came to hate because he was offshore and distant based in Florida, based in the United States. But now you see what happens when you get more localized ownership. So
yeah,
it wasn't particularly well done when you compare it to season one, Chris, but there were these narratives that I like that were pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, the financials are a huge part of this one, so much so that Charlie Methven is one of the lead characters in this second season, where he's really laser focused on generating as much money from every opportunity, as well as reducing costs, and we see that throughout this series. It is a major theme, and that's why I partly wonder too whether or not Sunderland had a little bit more influence this time in season two over the production or the recordings or what they did film and didn't film. But then again, though, too, League One is not going to be as exciting as the Championship in terms of even the relegation from the Premier League. All the drama, all the things that are happening in terms of scandals and this, that, and the other. And Jack Rodwell is just one example of season one, incredulity in terms of some of the things that happened in that season. But going through some of the other things in this second season, you had the transfer deadline day drama. That was really interesting to watch. You had Lyndon Gooch, the American, scoring the winner in the final minutes of the game in the first episode. The suspense of Will Gregg taking a penalty. What a competition, even such as the Checker Trade Trophy, means to a local community. Johnny Williams coming back and making a brief cameo. And in all of this, to me, Kartik, it shows that if anything comes out of this season two, it shows me how much heart and love there is for Sunderland among their local community. You really get to feel that more than in season one, I believe, in terms of just understanding what this club means to the local area. Going back to the financials, though, for a minute, though, Kartik, it was interesting in this second season where you had one of the communications manager, I think it was Sophia, and working really closely with Charlie Methven, and in terms of just trying to get those attendance numbers as high as possible, and him kind of bossing her around and her standing up for herself a little bit and saying, yep, we're working on it, we're focused on it. And then in one of the episodes, you see her packing her box and leaving, and there was no explanation of why. She left. It was just, and I thought it was right at the end of one of the episodes. I thought that the next episode would explain and go into talking to her about what happened. And although she was interviewed, I think even in the first episode, kind of where she was reflecting back on the season, that I thought was interesting. And they didn't completely. We can guess what happened, but they didn't completely tell us what happened. So that adds a little bit of intrigue to it. But I enjoyed it. I mean, to me, Kartik, too, also it shows, Sunderland obviously has high aspirations, wanting to get back into the Championship, wanting to, move back up the league. But it does show you how challenging the Championship and League One are in terms of the leagues. I mean, nothing is a given. Everything has to be earned. And there's some good teams in those leagues. They're playing good football, and it's a long, long season. I can imagine working at a club like that would be pretty stressful, especially if you're behind the scenes working at the club. But I enjoyed it. I really, really did. I thought it was again not as good as the first one, but definitely highly recommended. What about you?
I tend to agree, because I think the financials are a really important thing for people to understand, because and I don't want to preach too much here, but I'm just going to say this. There is always anger at your owner. There's always anger at particularly foreign owners among supporters bases in England and especially American owners or American based owners in the case of Ellis Short, right? He's an Irishman, but he lives in Florida and he's tax exile, all that stuff. But you have to kind of consider what happens with investment when you get those people sell the club and it's in the hands of someone who is much more spendthrift. And I think just as a reasonable example for Sunderland fans, they can think about their neighbor, their biggest rival, and how he's run that club, Newcastle, Mike Ashley. And unfortunately, you can be unhappy with your owners not being ambitious enough or being being absentee landlords. But then oftentimes when you get sold to a UK-based owner, they end up like Mike Ashley. He's not the only example of an owner like that. There are a lot of them around in the Football League. So that was, I think, a big takeaway and why this is an important watch for a lot of fans.
Yeah, it also shows the pressure of the transfer deadline day and a chairman having made a promise that he was going to bring players in, and it's the last day of the transfer window. No player has been brought in. There is one candidate, and the length that the chairman will go to fulfill that promise. I mean, it's kind of a, I mean, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, because it's one of those things. He had trying to sign somebody. If he didn't sign somebody, the fans would have been against him, saying like, you mean he's a spendthrift. If he did spend, maybe he would overspend and it may not be exactly the player he wanted, or that may not take off. And so it is one of those. You can see how difficult it is as a chairman in a club to run it efficiently, especially when times aren't going so well in terms of results and where you are in the league. Yeah, Kartik, I would not want that job. I don't know about you. I mean, I'm sure a Football Manager. Can you play the role of a chairman in Football Manager, or just it's always the manager?
It's always the manager, but the chairman. They make the relationship between chairman and manager such that these sorts of things happen. It seems inevitably. I mean, I don't know what happens if you manage like Manchester City or Chelsea, but the kind of clubs I've typically managed, there are these very difficult spending decisions, and oftentimes when you make a board request, you just get shot down. I mean, and in fact, it's come to the point in that game where I've waited for a board member to come to me and say, hey, yeah, you guys are doing so well. This would be a good time if you want to ask for something. And that's when I go and ask for extra transfer funds or better training facilities or better youth facilities or whatever, because mm-hmm. They almost over-simulate that Sunderland situation. But actually watching the documentary maybe gives me greater appreciation for Football Manager. That sort of thing. Maybe that's the way boardrooms work. Their general inclination is toward not giving enough leeway to the fans, to the manager, and yeah. then making certain demands about transfers. Now that was the January window where there's been less pressure on me in Football Manager, the one we really saw in full detail in this documentary. But for me, it's generally the summer window. And I have to tell you, now, of course, next season I think will be different, or if we get to next season. I recently jumped – I turned down the Chelsea job and the Man City job and the Everton job when I was at Cardiff. I recently took the Borussia Dortmund job when that became available and I was offered the job and applied. I have to say the big difference between the Bundesliga and the Premier League on the game, although the Bundesliga, at least early on, is a little tougher. Because Bayern is so good, it's difficult. The Premier League, everybody seems to beat everyone else, and more teams are dropping points. And the Bundesliga, you have to score more goals, which is also more difficult. But the key difference for me was the transfer window, was that I did not have to shut it down before the first match of the season. So you'd come out of the summer, and there was just no time. Right. To make transfers, and then inevitably the board would be angry at me or the chairman, and I wouldn't recover that trust when I was at Cardiff until mid-September, early October. There'd be fans upset because I hadn't made such and such transfer. Now, after starting my second season at Borussia Dortmund, that transfer window leeway is so important in that game. So this might explain why the Premier League, after doing it for two seasons, is backing off, and they're going to go back to a – well, again, we don't know when the season's going to be, but it appears like they're going to go back to a normal aligned window with the rest of Europe mm-hmm. soon.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe the sequel to the Football Manager computer simulation game will be Football Chairman. I think some people would get into that and say, let me see what I can do with this club, and some that might be coming down the path. And then, Sunderland Till I Die, I can see a Season 3 happening, and I mean, especially with everything going on with the coronavirus and the impact that would have on a club like that, or any club. I mean, that would be a good... I mean, so I wonder if the cameras have been rolling at least a little bit to give us an idea of what's happening inside that club. That would be really, really interesting to watch next season, hopefully when everything's back to normal. In terms of some of the other things I'll be watching this past week, Kartik, one thing is the launch of eLiga MX. So it's Liga MX's FIFA 20 tournament. And what they've done is they've taken the regular season of the Clausura that would have been played. And they have players from each of the teams competing against each other. So this debuted last Friday on TUDN in Spanish. No English language broadcast of this, but the way that they actually treated it in terms of the production and how they went about this was extremely professional. It felt as if it was like, I mean, the next big game in Liga MX, and they had the preview, they had the people in the studio talking about it. And the way it worked then is that they would transition to, okay, now we go into, the first game was Necaxa against Monterrey. Necaxa, we're going to have, I mean, there's a camera in the room for the Necaxa player sitting on the couch, and he says hi, and then we go over to the Monterrey player, and his camera showing him sitting on the couch too, getting ready to play. And then they can play against each other. The game itself, the EA Sports FIFA 20 on television, this would be the first time I've watched it on television. Of course, I've watched it on Twitch and other places and played it before. But on television, not so good. The iRacing, the NASCAR or any of the iRacing ones looks flawless. When you watch it on television, it looks like the real deal. FIFA definitely does not look like the real deal on television. Part of the issue was that it was laggy. There were times in this game where, you mean, it just would slow down, and you could tell that there was an issue an issue with the broadcast, whether it was on the FIFA server side or wherever it was, but it almost stopped at a couple of different places. But it was entertaining. It was fun to watch. Monterrey won 4-2. And it was great seeing the players kind of excited and just going through the emotions. I enjoyed it. And then so pretty much every day, almost every day, TUDN's got games from the league. So you can follow it through the entire season. Every weekend there's live games. I enjoyed it. If you're into FIFA, I highly recommend it. Also, Kartik, I watched the Belarusian Premier League, which is now live on YouTube and MyCujo. So as of last week, it was only live through their website, and you had to have you had to be, it was geo-blocked if you were in the US. So beginning last weekend, match day 4, they've been broadcasting live. No commentators, so you could just get the feed from the stadium. And there's actually, the fans are in the stadium. There's probably the one game I watched, which was Minsk against Bate Borisov, was they probably had a couple hundred fans in the stadium. No social distancing. I saw one person wearing a mask, and the players going at it. I mean, the quality level of the football itself isn't the greatest, but it was surreal to watch because it reminded me of the days after 9/11, where you'd look up into the sky, and normally you'd see planes flying over, and it was just silent. There was nothing there. And that was kind of for me, it felt surreal in a way, too, that we haven't seen a live soccer game in, about a month. And then switching on YouTube, watching it on my monitor, and seeing a game being played and seeing fans in the stadium. And it was that kind of feeling. I was like, wow, this seems really weird and strange, but it's happening. It's, I mean, just as the if the plane started flying again, and what we would see. And so far in Belarus, 26 deaths. Last time I checked, and over 2,000 cases. So it's not as if the COVID-19 virus does not exist there, but they're just deciding to play on. Kotick, anything else you watched this week?
No, I've been doing a lot more reading. And it's some old clips, etc. I should say I watched the FA Cup, the famous Arsenal Man United semifinal, which the FA replayed on YouTube this week. Just like FIFA's been doing, like right in real time, they would assign a time to it, and of course the magical Ryan Giggs moment.
Oh wow! Yeah.
But the thing that stood out about that match for me was, truthfully, how much more organized Arsenal was than I remember in some of those matches. You know, we think of them as just this free-flowing football. How much more organized they were, particularly in the latter stages of that match, which is what made Giggs's Maisie run so much more amazing. And then also how attack-minded United was, and particularly when you've got Beckham on one wing and you have Giggs on another, that they were organized, but I would say to a certain extent maybe less organized and less shape than Arsenal, which debunks the historical stereotypes of both Wenger and Ferguson. Now, of course, it was just one match, and those two teams played constantly in big matches over like a 6 or 7 year period, right? It was the ultimate matchup in English football. But the one takeaway from watching this match with 20 years of perspective on it was that maybe we had overstated Wenger's free-flowing nature and Ferguson's willingness to organize in a big matchup. Now, in fact, I think if you just think about the Barcelona finals in 2009 and 2011 of Champions League, Ferguson was much more willing to go at Barcelona, much more willing to play football, which is why Barcelona won both those matches easily. Whereas if you contrast that when Wenger took on Barcelona in 2011 in the same Champions League that they took United apart at Wembley in the final, Arsenal would have won that tie. There was a horrible call that cost them that. And I think Wenger missed a sitter at the end of the match. In that, over those two legs, Arsenal played very deep. They were very organized, and then they had in Fabregas, who would of course end up on Barcelona within a couple of months of that, a guy who could sit deep and play nice lofted long balls or lofted passes to the flanks. So maybe our historical stereotypes of both those managers was incorrect. I don't know, but that's the only other thing I watched, other than reading a lot about football and dealing with a lot of the fallout from the news this week in football, which I know we're going to get to in a few minutes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about people such as Sir Alex Ferguson or Arsene Wenger is that they changed. I mean, throughout their career in terms of the way that they approached football, I don't think it was a free-flowing football, and that was it. I think that one of the reasons for their success was they were able to change it depending on the situation. Except for Wenger, I mean, towards the latter years, it seemed to be that he was kind of stuck saying, okay, right, I'm just going to play this way, and we'll just play open attacking football, and we'll get, I mean, and then meanwhile, they would get just, I mean, hit big time by teams that were a little bit smarter about the way that they played against them. But yeah, that was a classic semi-final there, Kartik. Did you watch, or have you watched Soccer Town USA?
I have not. I've been meaning to, and I still haven't.
Okay. Yeah, I highly recommend it. It's now available on YouTube for free. It's the story of Kearney, New Jersey, the small little town, not too far away from New York, very close to Harrison, New Jersey. Home of the New York Red Bulls, and it talks about the players to come out of that town, about the history of the town, about a lot of mill workers from Scotland that emigrated from Scotland to the United States, And just as in the English game, oftentimes, like on a Saturday afternoon, they would have a little bit of free time and would form a team and start playing with each other against each other in different leagues and playing competitive soccer. And so this community grew. It included three major stars, among many. I mean, there's many others, but the three main ones that this documentary focuses on are John Hawkes, Tab Ramos, and Tony Meola, three of the greatest soccer players ever to play for the United States coming out of this small little town. Anyway, if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It talks about the New York Cosmos and the NASL, trying to qualify for the 1990 World Cup, playing in the 1994 World Cup, the formation of Major League Soccer, even going down to the high school level, how competitive high school soccer was, and the role of street soccer before there was even a thing called travel soccer. For somebody, again, if you haven't seen it, highly recommend it. Go check it out. Huge thumbs up from me on that one. And Kartik, now moving on to the TV streaming news, usually I have you kick it off. I'm going to kick it off on this time just because the story that we were going to talk about, I followed up to get some more additional details. So the story we were going to talk about was that NBC Sports and Comcast have started discussions with the Premier League about trying to renew the US rights in the next 12 months. The current TV deal ends in May 2022. Now, you would think that makes total sense. I mean, it's an opportunity right now to have discussions with the Premier League and talk about, hey, what can we do to renew the rights deal? Let's start up the discussions now. There's no live soccer on. We've got a little bit more extra time to kind of focus on these things. Well, I followed up with a couple of my sources, and both of them had said the same thing, that the story that was reported in the Daily Mail, I think it was by Matt Hughes, in their belief was incorrect, was that there have been no discussions between NBC Sports and the Premier League, nor Sky Sports and the Premier League. Now, those are my sources. Those are what my sources are telling me. It's quite possible. I mean, Sky Sports has, hundreds of employees, if not thousands. So does Comcast and NBC Sports. So there's a possibility of somebody having a discussion with the Premier League, but nothing formalized. There's still quite a long ways to go before those talks can even really... I mean, it's going to be next year, really, more likely, after we see what's happening with everything going on this summer, that this real discussions can happen. But anyway, that's one to keep an eye out for, is that whether NBC Sports, obviously they'll be wanting to renew that. And according to the article, I mean, in the article, it sounds like it would be a great time because maybe, the competitors, if it's CBS or DAZN or Hulu or Amazon, might be busy with other things, not focusing on the TV side. But I wanted it to be true, Kartik, but I guess it wasn't so.
Yeah, I think, honestly, it's going to be difficult to negotiate new agreements here because we don't know what the next few seasons are going to look like. Not only do we have this pandemic, but we do have World Cup 2022, which I've always feared might affect rights fees for domestic broadcasters, for domestic leagues. Yeah. So because that's going to interrupt the season. I mean, essentially, you're not going to have Premier League football in this specific case between mid-October, approximately mid-October and Boxing Day, right? I think Boxing Day might be the day they come back or maybe the date right before Christmas. Whatever that would be, December 23rd, whatever, 22nd. But maybe in the U.S. it doesn't matter as much because that coincides with the American football season, or at least historically. We don't know where seasons are going to shake out after all this. But so maybe it doesn't affect us as much. But I do have this concern, Chris, that nobody has talked about, that the next cycle of rights that there's going to be some effect on some of these leagues because of the breaks being elongated at times where generally they're matches, and that there are going to be more matches. The seasons are going to start earlier one season and later another season, putting matches in the summer. So that's something to really consider with these rights fees.
Yeah, and it could be too that for NBC Sports and the Premier League that it makes sense to renew those rights at when we get closer to 2022. and they may say, hey, we'll give you a make good because of that that year of 2020 when things went screwy and you guys weren't able to actually show the entire season in its completion or whatever it is, whatever happens. It may be best for them to work together to renew that, perhaps. We'll see. Next up, Kartik, is that speaking about previously E-Liga Max,
yep,
which is the FIFA 20 tournament, now Major League Soccer has done it now too. So Major League Soccer will debut EMLS on television. Now, they've had this on Twitch before, but this will be on television. This starts Sunday night at 7 p.m. on FS1. And I think the first game is Chicago against Cincinnati, and then that's followed by LAFC against LA Galaxy. The one interesting thing about this, Kartik, too, watching the E-Liga MX 1 and 2 Duene, is that the games are so short. I mean, the games were like 12-minute halves. So by the time you get started, you're watching it, it's, you know, 2-2, whatever it is, at halftime. Then it's a commercial break, and then you come back. I'm like, man, it would have been great if these games were actually a little bit longer. But I guess FIFA, the game itself, otherwise the score might be, I don't know, 6-6, 10-10, something like that. It's, I don't know, I just assumed that the games would have been longer and a little bit more depth to them. So so I know that, for example, FS1 on Sunday night will have those two games I mentioned, and then they'll have a game after that one, which will be the winner of the first game one and game two. So they're planning having three games within a couple of hours on the broadcast. But it'll be interesting to watch. I'll tune in.
Yeah, I just want to. Something about this is that this is going to be the third season, right? When you mentioned the previous 2 years have been on Twitch, and there has been a little bit of a following for it. And so now it's going to go mainstream on FS1. Of significant note, Chicharito is going to be playing for the Galaxy. So he is the guy who drives soccer fandom in this country more than any player, in my opinion, other than Messi and Ronaldo. I want to see if there's some sort of translation to him playing a video game. There might be. I mean, he has such a following and really kind of the personality to drive even English language dominant fans. So that to me is a big takeaway. By the way, Nani is going to be playing for the Orlando City team, which is also kind of exciting for Man United fans. And a couple other big stars will be part of this as well.
Next news item is that the International Champions Cup this summer has been cancelled. No surprise there. The fear with this one, though, is that Stephen Ross, who owns Relevant Sports and also owns the Miami Dolphins, and is the person that's really funding the International Champions Cup, has mentioned, I think it was in the New York Times a couple of months ago, that that he was looking now to, this is before coronavirus happened, looking to the clubs to be financing more of this, and rather than all the money coming out of his pocket. And was casting fears that perhaps ICC, the future of that, was in question slightly, perhaps. And again, this is before coronavirus. So now with ICC being cancelled this summer and probably definitely rescheduled for next summer. But again, next summer you've got the Olympics, you've got Copa America, you've got the Euros, and you've got leagues probably wanting to try to catch up on making up lost games. Who knows how ICC would fit into that also? So the question is, I mean, this is kind of more of an open question, Kartik. I don't know, you don't have to answer it, but is the future of ICC, there's definitely a huge question mark about that going into the future.
Yeah, I think also Ross wants to do something with UEFA that would compete with the World Club Cup potentially, right? So that might be, and that would ostensibly be using the ICC model to become an actual a competitive competition. I get the sense if that doesn't happen, this thing might drop out, and you'd still see him bring occasional friendlies to Ann Arbor and to Miami in particular, those two places where he's very well connected. I think he'll continue to bring. We saw him bring a friendly last year to Miami that I attended, Barcelona and Napoli. That was outside the ICC umbrella, right? It was just it was another game. Mm-hmm. I think he dubbed it something, but it was another. It was just another match that I think Relevant will continue to do. I do think that the future of the ICC is in significant doubt if he cannot get UEFA to do this thing where they're competitive matches. Now, I have to say this. Another football manager perk playing in the World Club Cup on Football Manager has me appreciating how short that offseason is and how difficult it is to heal players and have full fitness for your team if you play in that competition. So Football Manager doesn't have the ICC and they're not competitive matches and you can make 8 substitutions or whatever. But I understand now if you have a competitive tournament with clubs over the summer, you almost have to do something with your calendar, with your and this goes back to the point about the rights fees for the Premier League and other leagues, with your calendar, with your August to May, because these footballers aren't machines. And I think especially after this pandemic, we understand public health concerns maybe trump sporting concerns. So I don't know where everything's going to shake down. It's possible the sport will look completely different in a couple of years, and you will have Stephen Ross and the ICC as a competitive tournament over the summer, and maybe the Bundesliga and the Premier League and the Liga, they don't kick off till September. I don't know. Maybe that's what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, and the FIFA Club World Cup, the inaugural one, the way that FIFA wants to run it in the future, which looks very much like ICC, the first one is supposed to be scheduled for next summer, 2021, I think, in China. So, it's interesting because in many ways clubs will be looking for ways to generate quick revenue more now than in the than in the past. So there could be an ICC where it makes sense, where they're looking at it as a way to generate a ton of money. But then again, they're too Kartik. Who knows if there'll be any people in the stadiums? And who knows if there are people in the stadiums, how many tickets will be sold? I mean, so there's so many different variables. It's too early to tell. But it's certainly one to keep an eye out for. Next up is some comings and goings in the soccer talent space. And first of all, that's former beIN Sports presenter Kay Murray has landed on her feet and been hired by ESPN. She made the news official this week on her social media account. She actually got hired earlier this year, but didn't want to make the announcement until after the birth of her baby and her first appearance on ESPN. And on Wednesday, I believe it was, she appeared on air on ESPN's SportsCenter Global. So it looks like she's going to be doing more of the global broadcasts for ESPN on the sports side. And with her being there in Bristol, Connecticut, or actually she was broadcasting from home though, but being in the Northeast, maybe perhaps there's a chance that she'll be on some of the soccer broadcasts, maybe the Bundesliga or some other things. We don't know yet. It's too early to tell. But she has been hired by ESPN, which is fantastic news.
Yeah, and I think also you might see her be part of something like the simulcast that ESPN, I can't remember if it was ESPN News or ESPN2 used to do. Remember with these kind of small segments from SportsCenter Global and including Champions League coverage, etc. Now that was before they had this whole ESPN FC setup, so maybe not. But that's another place where she might pop up on American television talking about soccer again.
So good news for Kay Murray. Bad news, though, for Grant Wall, who has been fired by Sports Illustrated magazine. And this is something I never want to see, never like seeing people getting fired. But in this case, it was the new owner of Sports Illustrated, Maven, looked to be pretty insulted by some of the things that Grant Wall was saying publicly about that corporation. So within days of some of the things he'd been saying, he'd been fired. Personally, I mean, I like Grant Wall as a writer. I think he's a great writer. He has a great list of contacts. The thing that I've always been a big critic of him for was that when he was working with Fox Sports and when he was doing a lot of the broadcast on the, whether it would be talking about the U.S. presidential election for U.S. soccer, he was really, really soft on a lot of the You mean the Sunil Galatis, the Carlos Corderos, the Kathy Carters? I mean, kind of really kind of seem to be playing more to that side, and less so, didn't seem to be giving a lot of time to the people such as Eric Rinalda, Carlo Martino, and many others that were running in opposition. So he seemed to be very much part of the establishment. All right, Kartik, let's move on to two best soccer films and documentaries of all time for consideration. We did part one in the last episode. We'll go through part two pretty quickly on this one, just because we've got a long list of ones to share. So let's not go too in-depth as far as our thoughts on it, just because of the limits of time. First up is Hillsborough, which is, to me, it is a must-see documentary. This one was, when we mentioned it on Twitter, I think there were a lot of people saying, why is this a must-see? Like, why is this included in this list? And it's included because, in many ways, it is the explanation of what happened. It goes into a lot of detail, which is, I mean, it's sad, it's depressing, it's horrifying. But before this documentary existed, there were two sides to the story. There were a lot of people that said that, yeah, it was all the Liverpool fans' fault. Don't listen to the Inquiry. It was, I mean, the Liverpool fans were the ones that caused this. When in actual fact, it was a lot of mistakes that happened by the police, and in terms of the way that the fans were segregated, and the police control of this whole situation. So this documentary, to me, again, is just one of the all-time greats. More so for the investigative part of it, in terms of going through hundreds of hours, if not thousands of hours of research and film to put together this really just incredible documentary about what happened that fateful day. Next up is, I'm not sure if you saw this one, Kartik, Diego Maradona, the documentary that came out, HBO premiered it, I think it's in September last year.
Yeah, I was actually supposed to go to the opening. I was invited to it, and then I had to travel with Miami FC to an away match, and so I still haven't seen it.
Yeah, this one is amazing because, going back into the 1980s, his time moving to Napoli, and you would never expect there to be so much film available of him. You mean just in just kind of casual, just hanging out at his house or going to trainings. And it's one of those things that who knew how many cameras were on him. But it's a really, really good documentary. The soundtrack is amazing. It's I think Giorgio Moroder has got a lot of the music on there. But yeah, highly recommended. So check that one out. The next one, this one is on the list, I think for one scene only, Kartik. Maybe there's more to it than that, but Being Liverpool, which was a documentary that was produced by Fox Sports. This was Fox Sports' entry into saying, okay, all right, we're going to start making documentary films, and we're going to start putting a lot of money investing into making films and documentaries. And this one, I remember it because of one scene. What about you, Kartik? Actually, there's more than one scene. There's actually a couple of memorable scenes from this one.
Yeah, the scene with Joe Allen. Is that the scene you're thinking about?
No.
Because it's a Swansea
supporter. Well, not that one. Raheem Sterling.
I don't remember the Raheem Sterling.
In training, when this is a young Raheem Sterling, before anyone really knew who he was, and he was training with Liverpool, and Brendan Rodgers came over, and I can't remember what he said, but he was like, basically, if you're not going to concentrate on the football, get the hell out of here.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, now I remember. Yeah.
And then the other scene I remember from this one was the envelope scene, where it's what's it, pre-season, I think it is, and Brendan Rodgers is talking about the team for the upcoming season, and he's like, you mean either you try your hardest or you don't, and I've got in this envelope I've got a list of names of people that I've that right now are not going to be on this team for this upcoming season. And then the way that they shot it in the hotel is that you have the light shining through the envelope, and you can see the envelope, there's nothing in it, it's blank. So mind games here from Brendan Rodgers as far as trying to, you mean, really incentivize his players to push harder to make this team to strive to be a better player. Those are the two scenes I remember. There's probably some other scenes in it too. It's worth watching. It's not as good as it could have been. Next up, Kartik, Goal. Did you see this one? The film?
Oh, the film. Yeah. I saw it, and I saw Goal 2 also, which was which wasn't as good as Goal 1, right? Significantly.
Yeah, Goal 1 was okay though. It was pretty good. It's worth watching. I think. I mean, it's not going to be. It's not on my all-time top list, but it's that's the thing about soccer in general is that there's so few good films about the sport. We talked about that last episode with Victory or Escape to Victory, which was one of the better ones. But Goal, it's worth watching. The premise was good of taking a player from I think Los Angeles. Someone playing like kind of street soccer and a scout finding him and then taking him to Newcastle and him trying to make it there. The premise was good. Next up, Green Street Hooligans. This is more of a mainstream movie, Kartik, right?
I should mention on Goal the reason why Santiago Munoz, right, that was his name, played for Newcastle, then played for Real Madrid, and was involved with Argentina and Mexico was because of Adidas having a role with the movie. And the reason why MLS was promoted in early scene in the scouting combine where he gets this, quote, discovered by the Newcastle scout. But that was my first real experience in a soccer movie with extensive product placement where also I don't think there were matches that were aired against Nike opponents, right? It was an Adidas series. And that's why, for example, he didn't play for the US in the movie internationally because the US was Nike.
I didn't think of it that way. Now I think of the movie in a different way, a different light completely.
And that's why he went to Newcastle at the time, which is obviously Puma now.
Heavy Adidas at the time, though.
Yeah, exactly.
So Green Street Hooligans, this was, again, more of a mainstream movie about West Ham United fans in the late 70s, early 80s. It's a fun watch. I enjoyed watching this one. I'd probably watch it again if it was on HBO or if I was just flipping through the channels and saw it. It was fine. Graham Taylor, An Impossible Job. I'm not sure if you saw this one, Kartik. This was the fly in the wall documentary about England manager Graham Taylor. And this one is a must see. This one has got some really, really good footage of, he's mic'd up at times, so you get to hear some of the things he's saying on the sidelines. And it's going through a period of time that for England was kind of a darker time in terms of not qualifying for major tournaments or not doing so well, even though the players were fantastic. Gives you some insight into that job, which was an impossible job because you had the pressure of and expectations of the fans and the media, and it really gives you an idea of how challenging that position is. Bend It Like Beckham. This is one of my wife's favorites. I enjoyed it. It's not much Beckham in it, which is okay. And the story is decent about women footballers. To me, I prefer Gregory's Girl, which is a classic movie filmed in Scotland in the late 70s, early 80s. If you can find that one's much better. But there you go. The Class of 92, Kartik. I know you like this one, right?
Yeah, I like this movie a lot. I think that this is a really good look at that Manchester United set of players that became so historic. Nicky Butt and Phil Neville, I think it's fair to say, did not become as good players as the other, what would it be, four of them. Now, the thing that's so significant about this to me is that those two seem to be the guys that were thought of as being like really elite. I mean, I think everybody knew Giggs was, right? But more so than Scholes, of the Neville brothers, Phil Neville was thought to be the better of the Neville brothers. Still had a great career, don't get me wrong. But and Nicky Butt, I think people thought was going to be a better player than David Beckham.
Yep. And then next up, All or Nothing. Manchester City. So I didn't see this one. I know you did. I think you had mixed feelings about this one.
Yeah, it's I mean, I guess it's interesting if you want to look. I guess maybe there are people who look for different things in documentaries than me. They look for a situation where you have an uber successful club and a coach whose methods you want to emulate and you can pick up things from. So I do respect that there were a lot of people who wanted to see how Pep Guardiola operates and how really high-end successful players operate and in a very propagandish way, right, mm-hmm. from the club. Now, I tend to – and I'm a Manchester City supporter. I tend to appreciate documentaries about adversity, strife, and clubs overcoming that or clubs failing. That's why Sunderland Till I Die, I think, is so much more interesting than any series can be that could possibly be made about recent-day Manchester City or Juventus or, you know, Borussia Dortmund, right? These clubs that are elite clubs in world football. The Dortmund one was gave a little more behind the scenes. That was an Amazon series also, but not, you know, it's more or less the same as Manchester City. So I didn't care too much for this. I did go back and watch it a couple weeks ago because now it's available in 4K, which it wasn't. At least I didn't watch it in 4K when it first came out in 2018 summer. So I actually ended up watching it a second time and with the radar, as we talked about on Amazon Prime. So there was a little more layers to it the second time I watched it, but still I think it should be further down people's lists, in my opinion.
Next up is George Best, All By Himself, which was, I believe, that was the 30 for 30 documentary by ESPN. Yeah. This one I know you watched, right, Kartik?
Yeah, yeah, and I'm a big fan of this. Not only did I watch it, I own it. So this is the documentary that I went ahead and bought after the 30 for 30, or after it had aired on ESPN. I paid $14.99 or whatever. I own it. And I have not watched it a second time, but I have this peace of mind knowing I own it and I can watch it anytime. And that's how good I thought it was.
So this next one I have not seen, Kartik. I have it on my list. I've always wanted to get to watch it. Never had a chance. I will watch it in the future, definitely, hopefully soon. Next Goal Wins, starring manager Thomas Rongen. Right?
Yeah.
Did you watch this one?
I did, and I think that there was a lot of excitement, particularly here in South Florida, because we all know Thomas so well. About this documentary, and it was really good. The premise of it is that you have a country, American Samoa, that's not going to qualify, right, for anything, but basically the odds are against them. But you see Thomas's connection with the players, and this is why young players, if you talk about the likes of the Jozy Altidores and the Michael Bradleys and the Freddie Adus, or obviously Freddie didn't turn out to be as good as people had hoped, and the Eddie Johnsons, there was a generation of American young players who Thomas had an incredible impact on. And I could go even further back here in South Florida when he managed Nova University and managed College of Boca Raton, which is now Lynn University. The young players who came out of there, who were kind of my contemporaries, my age group, who he so positively influenced. You see it in this film. It's inspirational. Again, I prefer documentaries about adversity. And of course, maybe I'm partial because there's someone I think very highly of and consider a friend in the movie as a starring figure in the movie. But this is the sort of thing I like to watch because it's about adversity and it's about challenging that adversity. Whether you completely overcome it or not, there's something more interesting about it than watching something on Manchester City when they win every match. And it's just a matter of whether they win 2-1 or they win 5-1, right?
Mm-hmm. Speaking of adversity, the next up is one of my favorites. It's Jack Tua King, The Swansea Story. And if you like Sunderland Till I Die, I think you'd like this one. It's a story of a club that's near the bottom of the fourth division, one game to go. They have to win it in order to stay in the league. Otherwise, they will go down to non-league. And, I mean, could be the end of the club. They're practically almost bankrupt. They got just chairmen that are just running the club into the ground, and they have one game to win. And from there, spoiler, they win the game, and then you see them moving up the leagues and trying to get into the Premier League and everything that's involved in that. So check it out. I think that one's on iTunes, but it might be on other places too. But Jack Tua King, The Swansea Story. Next up is The Impossible Dream, which is the documentary that NBC Sports put together, and I think they worked in conjunction in the UK, one of the sports companies there, but networks there. But it's the story of the treble winning season for Manchester United in 1999, winning the Champions League, FA Cup and league title, and just an incredible documentary. Some really good interviews with Clive Tilsley and many people involved in that incredible, former Man United players involved in that incredible season. Rise and Shine, the Jay Demerick story. This is one I enjoy and I've watched, and I can't remember what it was about it that I felt when I left it. I was like, this is good, but I was expecting something more. I remember what it is. I'd heard the story so many times. I think I interviewed Jay once or twice and then read his story. And then when I watched the documentary, I was like, okay, there's nothing new here. This is exactly how I remembered it. So if you don't know the Jay Demerick story and how he got rejected by an MLS club and then went to England to try to make it as a professional soccer player, I'd recommend watching this one, Rise and Shine, the Jay Demerick story. Take Us Home, Leeds United, available on Amazon Prime right now. This one I enjoyed. It was the first few episodes are fantastic. As the season goes along and as the episodes go along, it's not as good as it towards the end of it, but I still recommend it. It's still really worth watching. Again, more of a fly on the wall insights into how clubs are run behind the scenes, especially when you have Bielsa and the boardroom at Leeds United. This is a really fascinating story. Bobby Robson, More Than a Manager. Man, if you want to cry a little bit, or just this is an incredible story of somebody who was successful as a player and as one of the best managers in the world, both at the club level and the international level. And just the story of Bobby Robson, just Ipswich Town, taking this small club and helping them to win managing them to win the first division, which is now the Premier League. Just an incredible story and an amazing man, a really incredible man. So if you haven't seen this one, highly recommend that one too. Mike Bassett, England manager, if you're ready for some laughs.
Yeah.
This is a good one. Yeah, this is a good one. It's kind of almost like a parody of the Graham Taylor in An Impossible Job, or some of the England managers where you've got somebody that, it just is really, really funny. A lot of English humor in this one. Mike Bassett, England manager, recommend that one too. And before I handed it back over to you, Kartik Matthews, I mentioned last week's podcast, the story about Stanley Matthews on Amazon, right now on Amazon Prime, I think it is. Amazing documentary, really, really good about the life and times of one of the best English footballers in the world ever. And Kartik, I know you added a few others that weren't on the list. You want to share?
Yeah. So I think This Is Football is really good. I never finished it the first time when it came out, summer of 2019. It's an Amazon original. And I like that it's not overly British and anglicized, because I think so many of the documentaries we watch in English language are taken from a British perspective. So there's a lot of German and Dutch. It's still kind of pan-European. I think European perspectives, even about African and Asian football, but it's you've got these different perspectives in there, and there's a lot of good stuff on the Bundesliga. There's a lot of good stuff on the Swiss League and things like that, and Serie A. So I like that. Summer of 92 is a movie which is about the summer of – well, it is obviously about the summer of 92, but it's about the Danish triumph in the Euro 92 tournament, which was filled with adversity. You had star players who were fighting with other star players. You had an FA and a manager fighting. You had star players fighting with the manager. You had star players saying, hey, I'm on holiday, I'm not going to go, because they had gotten into the tournament at the last minute when Serbia, Yugoslavia, were kicked out for human rights violations and the war that was going on in the Balkans at the time under Slobodan Milosevic. And then they end up winning the Euro. So it's really – it's kind of – there's kind of humor mixed into the narrative, which is very kind of serious, and the dark sides of the narrative, which is the constant infighting. So I really like that film. And then I Believe in Miracles, which came out 2 years ago, I think, now, about Brian Clough and Nottingham Forest. That we've seen I think a really interesting thing about the the things on Clough we've seen, and I think maybe it's skewed by Damned United, which we talked about last week, is such a great movie, Chris.
Yep.
But there's so much more, I think, in the U.S. identification now with Clough and his time at Derby versus his time at Forest. It's important to note he took Forest, a provincial team, in the Midlands, in the East Midlands, to a league title and then two European Cups in a row. Nottingham has won more European Cups as a city than London has, which is pretty amazing. So it's about that era and that era players. Martin O'Neill, as a player, who I think we all now know as a fantastic manager, plays a big role in that documentary. And in he's kind of the spitting image of Clough, right? And he turned into that sort of manager. And a number of other top players from that era. The other thing about this is I think there was a love affair between Clough and Peter Taylor. The documentary doesn't really get into when Taylor leaves Clough and goes to manage Derby, where of course they had been together for those successful years, so successful seven seasons from 67 to 73, and their friendship broke apart from that point, and they never reconciled until Clough passed away, and if I remember correctly, or sorry, until Taylor passed away, if I remember correctly, it was because of a player moving from Forest to Derby, some sort of transfer that soiled their relationship. But yeah, if you like Brian Clough, if you like talk of outsider clubs winning things, check out this film. And I think it also reminds us that at the time Clough took over Forest, Notts County had kind of the more established big history. They're both old clubs. They're both traditional clubs in Nottingham, but it was very much a two-club town. And what has happened, what has progressed over the course of the last, even though Nottingham Forest has been out of the top flight for 20 years, what has progressed over the last 40-plus years, is that Notts County has been reduced in scope, and Forest has, in some respects, a global following. So a really pivotal time, even in football in that town.
Yeah, and that was a really, really good documentary. I remember watching that one too. I Believe in Miracles. Even if you're a fan of, say, 1970s or 1980s soccer, that's also a good look to that one too. It's just an incredible documentary and an incredible story there. All right, Kartik, let's move on to the listener mailbag. We've got some recommendations for documentaries too and movies from some of our listeners. But first up is Alan, and he says, a couple of weeks ago on your podcast, you and Kartik mentioned that you have been playing Football Manager 2020. I have never played video games, but with plenty of time on my hands in this lockdown, I thought I'd give it a try. I can now confirm to yourselves and to your listeners that playing Football Manager 2020 can make whole days of your life disappear. In fact, over the last week, the only time that I haven't played the game is when I've been watching instructional videos on YouTube about how to play the game. I'm not sure that I will play when my life returns to some kind of normal, but for now, it is a good substitute for watching live football and football documentaries. I don't know whether to thank you or curse you. Oh, great stuff. Yeah, and we can relate to that too. I mean, I think Kartik and I are both extremes. Me not wanting to get into it, knowing how much time it's going to take, and then Kartik having engaged in Football Manager for many, many years, knowing how much time it takes, and then being able to try to balance it.
Yeah, and so yeah, I'm going to respond to this, that there's been in this month now, I think, of a shutdown, or more than a month of a shutdown, there have been times where I have told myself, do not pick the game up. And so I've gone 4 or 5 days without playing, and then when I pick it up, then nothing else gets done. And then it's like 4 or 5 days of just manic, just constant playing, and my sleep patterns are affected. Whatever else I'm working on is affected. So it's, I think in this period, it's gotten even worse because there's always the temptation to play it. Whereas oftentimes I had discipline prior to this, although not enough discipline. It's addictive. The time commitment is enormous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Yeah. I can't believe it's been a month, Kartik. It's been over a month since, We've got the Belarusian Premier League, but in terms of, you mean, whether it's the last matches we watched would have been Liga MX matches, the behind closed doors ones.
Yeah.
And this month has in some ways flown by, in other ways crawled by, but I'm sure listeners can appreciate that. Next up is Mike Zale. Mike says, I really enjoy your work. I am a huge fan of beIN Sports and actually cut the cord with Comcast as a result of their dispute. Besides Fubo, my most watched app on Roku is beIN Sports Connect. I'm wondering, though, why beIN does not add the new beIN Sports Extra to their Connect app. For me, it is becoming increasingly annoying to have to use a completely different app, such as Pluto, to access beIN's own content. Now, Mike, this is a great example of how confusing this can be and how frustrating it can be. So not only can you watch beIN Sports Extra, the free one, on Pluto, but they also have their own exclusive app too. So if you have a Roku, you can just go to the app specifically and watch content there. Some of the content on the beIN Sports Extra app, which is the free one, is exclusive to that app. Most of it, though, is kind of really rebroadcasts of other content from beIN Sports. So his question is kind of why couldn't they have included the beIN Sports Extra content in the Connect app? I think in many ways, I think they want to try to have this app be free and accessible no matter what happens. I mean, this wouldn't happen, but say if Fubo said tomorrow, okay, that's it, we're ending our relationship with beIN Sports, and now Fubo TV subscribers could not access beIN Sports Connect and then would miss out on all that content. That beIN Sports Extra app is still available to everyone no matter what cable service or TV service or you don't need any service. You can still access that no matter what. So for people who do watch a lot of sports and a lot of soccer specifically and do watch content on beIN Sports Connect, which I do too, Mike, and I know a lot of listeners do too, is it does become more complicated because it's, okay, which game is it going to be on? Is it on the Extra app today, or is it, which is usually the French league, or is it on beIN Sports Connect, and which one do I have to load up? It is a pain in the neck. But I guess beIN Sports probably thought, okay, let's go for the mainstream. Let's try to make it as accessible as possible and not worry about the actual current subscribers or current customers. It's messy. Hopefully in the future they can correct that. Next up is Jim Hennessy. Jim says, I would like to throw the documentary No Sir Chape 2019 into the mix. This documentary tracks the rebuilding of the Brazilian team Chapecoense after the devastating plane crash that wiped out the team in 2016. The documentary is incredibly moving, hard to find now. I think it is available on Fox Now. I have not seen that, Kartik. I know that it's supposed to be really, really good. I have to add that to my watch list.
Yeah, and actually, since this is being mentioned, and I have such painful memories of that, and actually have a Chapecoense kit I bought after that. I think there was just this outpouring in the football world. Another movie, if you can stomach it, is United, which is about Munich.
Yeah, that was good. That was a really good one.
It's very good. But the disclaimer is it's really difficult to watch. Obviously,
yeah,
you know, if you're not bawling, if you're not in tears by the end of that movie, I don't know what's if you're a human being. I haven't seen this, and thank you, Jim, for the suggestion. It's probably similar. Mm-hmm. I will watch it at least once.
Next up is Bradley Moore. Bradley says, you were mentioning in your last pod about documentaries that follow clubs that are rising up the ranks and tracks the club year after year. One series I have not seen like that is the Class of 92 out of their league, where the Man United Class of 92, Neville, Scholes, Giggs, Butt, buy lowly Salford City with the help of Peter Lim. And over the course of the four seasons they have shown thus far, went from the seventh tier of English football to now playing in the Football League. The most telling thing about this series was the transformation of the club, not just in squad, but also in terms of facilities, bathrooms that don't work, pie shop is being up to code, etc. And the volunteers that helped keep that club afloat before large investment came in. Something to keep in mind with respect to promotion relegation, which I am for, you do need people to help keep the lights on. The early seasons had been up on Netflix. The latter seasons aired on Sky Sports in the UK. And this one, yeah, I remember watching this one about a year ago, around about. I enjoyed it. I didn't watch the whole series, maybe for part of the reason that, you mean, not all the episodes were available on whatever streaming service I was using at the time. But yeah, if you can find that one, that's a highly recommended one also. Dave Roberts says, Dave says, on a recent podcast, you were discussing briefly the documentary Once in a Lifetime. I'm wondering if you've read the book version of the film. While I agree with you that the film did do wonders for the nostalgia of the original NASL and actually made me long for those teams, even though I was born at the time when the league was already beginning its decline. The book, however, really goes into its excellent detail to explain why it is considered to be a failure. It discusses the fiscal management, the overexpansion, and the various business and marketing mistakes that the league made, which led to its eventual implosion. If the filmmakers were maybe afforded another hour in the final cut of the film, they could have gone into the same details which the book's author was able to explore. After reading the book, I was given a much better understanding as to why the league is considered a failure, even though there was about a decade where it seemed like NASL was going to be one of the big four leagues in America. I've even joked that the book should be taught in business schools for how not to run a sports league. Also made me appreciate some of the steps MLS took in its early years to ensure its long-term sustainability. Thanks again for your podcast and for reading this email. Kartik, I did not read the book. I know you're more of a book lover. I love books,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I have read it. I own the book. I think of what ends up happening in the book, that's a lot of it is similar to the documentary, and even some of the quotes are exactly the same as the documentary, which oftentimes when books are interpreted into films or vice versa, it doesn't happen. So I appreciate that. Gavin Newsom, by the way, not Gavin Newsom, the mayor, the governor of California, former mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom, who's British, is the author. But then there is a lot about financial controls, over expansion, wrong markets, TV deals, and actually the TV aspect the film gets a little into, right, with Lee Stern, who had been the owner of the Chicago Sting, and how he felt ABC should have rolled out their game of the week or their package. So there's a lot of, I think, justification in the book for why MLS operated. And the book was written in 2006. So MLS at that time has already contracted, and they have had these incredibly tight controls on spending, which they don't have anymore. They still have controls, but they don't have the kind of tight controls. Really, from 2002 to 2007, they had ridiculous controls on spending. It's almost written as a justification for that. So I read the book in 2006 or 2007, liked it, may have even written a review for one of our old sites, EPL Talk or World Soccer Talk, of the book, not of the film. We'd all seen the film. As time has gone on, I've fallen less in love with that book or fallen out of love with the book because I think it is constructed as a justification of the way MLS is operating.
Yeah.
So and it could, that may not then color my views of whether it's really a good book. And I preferred Ian Plenderleet's Rock and Roll Soccer, which was written more recently. I preferred that as a retrospective about the NASL to Once in a Lifetime because Plenderleet does not use NASL's failure at the end as a justification for MLS. He hardly mentions MLS in the book, which is very Plenderleet, by the way. you and I both talked about him for many years. So, but it's more of a balanced kind of maybe overly romantic retrospective Plenderleet's book, but I would suggest reading Ian Plenderleet's Rock and Roll Soccer.
There you go. So you got another great book recommendation there. John Average Geek says, loved the late 90s DC United teams. It is what MLS needed at the start. I think MLS Extra Time just had Kevin Payne on, and it was a great interview on how they built the team. And last but not least, Raymond Roscoe says, do you think the Beckham experiment actually helped English soccer more than MLS when it comes to converting fans here in the United States? And I think so. I've never thought about it this way, Kartik, but I think so in many ways. I think that oftentimes Major League Soccer, I mean, it has been here, I mean, since like, what, the late 90s. But oftentimes it's been, like, for example, the MLS All-Star Games and the teams coming through and then International Champions Cup and all the what MLS has helped bring into this country, which has been a lot of foreign teams playing on the soil in the beginning, kind of playing against a lot of these MLS teams, and then taking someone like David Beckham, you know, a star in Europe, bringing him to Major League Soccer and LA Galaxy. Yes, it definitely helped Major League Soccer, but it may have actually helped the Premier League and English soccer even more so, where people would watch the games and go like, wow, okay, let me get into the story of Manchester United and watching Real Madrid or watching, it's almost like a good gateway drug, David Beckham is, into other soccer. So for the mainstream audience, I think that could very well much be true, that actually helped the Premier League more than it did Major League Soccer in the long term.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Raymond. I've never thought about it that way. But if you look at the timing as to when English football in particular began to really explode in the United States, it kind of coincides with Beckham coming here and there, I think, just being a deepening interest in the sport in general. And MLS taking advantage of Beckham to a certain extent, but also not able to fully leverage it. I think we know how angry MLS people, how personally they took Beckham's desire to play for AC Milan,
right?
And PSG, during that period, right. how offended they were and how insecure they were about it. I think that Beckham engineering, and obviously that was to an Italian club, not to an English club, but still kind of reinforced were to people who may have just been opening up their soccer fandom, where MLS stood in the global game. And remember, Chris, I mean, I don't know if people recall this, how much anger there was among the MLS, the same people who would argue against ProRel now, about Beckham doing that and going to AC Milan, and how Milan was being disrespectful to Major League Soccer and Beckham had a contract, and how dare he put this above MLS. And remember all of that? It was nuts.
Yeah.
But I think that created some of the situation where people began exploring foreign leagues.
Yeah, it's a great question and some great points there too, Kartik, from you in terms of, in hindsight, thinking back to it, I can see that. I mean, we saw that a little bit too with Frank Lampard when he ended up playing for Manchester City when we thought he was coming over to play for NYCFC, and just the pecking order as far as the priority list of where these professional athletes placed the clubs in order. And it wasn't with Major League Soccer at the top, even though they were, hired by Major League Soccer to play in that league.
Yeah, I mean, when Henry went back to Arsenal for 2 months or whatever, I mean, and that was particularly special because he's so connected to that club. But yep. And it allowed him to finish his European career playing for Arsenal rather than for Barcelona, which I particularly liked because obviously he'd come from Barcelona to Major League Soccer. But there were a lot of those, right? Robbie Keane went to Aston Villa for a couple of months, which was interesting because he had played for a number of clubs. And
he played for Wolves.
He played for Coventry, right? Do I remember?
I think he started out there.
Played for two clubs that are direct rivals, local rivals of Villa. So he goes and plays for Villa also, which was neat. And then I remember Omar Gonzalez went to Nuremberg. The famous case of this actually is when, speaking of Nottingham Forest, a great way to end the show, when Ben Olsen, whose entire career was in Major League Soccer otherwise, went to Nottingham Forest on loan, but then got hurt. But it was one of those loans where he was going during the MLS offseason to stay fit, and he got injured there. But who knows? He might have played well enough for Forest that they would have tried to buy him.
Hmm. Interesting. All right. Well, we want you to have your say. So if you have any recommendations for books, for documentaries, if you disagree or agree with anything we've said, or if you have some questions such as the question that Mike had about streaming, being sports or streaming any soccer, basically, let us know. You can always reach us via email through web at worldsoccertalk.com, as well as facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, and on Twitter at worldsoccertalk. Plus, of course, you can post your comments on worldsoccertalk.com, the website that started this all. And Kartik, in terms of where we're at with things, we're kind of in a stage where there's been discussions of soccer coming back potentially in May. Then we're hearing June. I mean, the dates being thrown out are constantly changing. It's kind of it's an ongoing process. But for the listeners, we do appreciate you sticking around, listening to this podcast every week. We really enjoy doing it. Talking about the things that we've been watching, as well as some recommendations of things to watch. Hopefully all of this will return to normal at some point in the future, with games at least behind closed doors, just to fulfill the obligations and take it step by step, just as we've been going with this podcast throughout this past month. But yeah, so if you haven't checked it out, also the Heart of the Game podcast series, the latest interview is with Phil Bonney, who is one of the top Bundesliga commentators and also a fan of Southampton Football Club. A really good interview there. And Kartik, what's going on in your life before we close out? Anything interesting? Anything exciting going on?
I've just been absorbed in this book about Florida history I'm writing, and the unfortunate thing or fortunate thing, you can I don't know how to describe it. Basically, you start doing historical research with one premise in mind, and then you get kind of drawn to another to where the research takes you. So. The thing that now is coming out in my research is that there is an incredible amount of religious motivation, or religion plays a big part in the development of Florida and the development of the 13 colonies to the north, and why people fought on one side in the American Revolution or not, to the point where it was very much kind of a civil war. And I think there's that general theme in English history, right? And this is basically an extension of English history, what I'm talking about, even though it's on the U.S. soil. But there's different things with different religious denominations, which were fascinating, that I hadn't really thought about before I started researching. So you learn something every day.
Yeah, and for those listeners who may not know, so Kartik's writing a book about Florida history, from kind of the British side in terms of the British influence, but obviously intertwined with the Spanish. But the book title... I mean, it's a long title, but it's called Albion. But yeah. So what's the connection between Albion? Like, so if you look at, say, West Bromwich Albion or Brighton and Hove Albion, and then the name of the book, Albion, talking about Florida history, what's the connection there? What's the...
It's kind of a historic term for Britishness. So one of the things that's really kind of weird is that West Brom and Brighton, and there are a few other, Burton Albion, there are a couple clubs that have stuck it in their... club name, mm-hmm. when it's actually just kind of a general term for Britishness, the island. It may be laying claim to more than just England in mm-hmm. a way, maybe for all of Great Britain. But I picked the term because it just sounds different. It was going to originally be something Florida and Britain, and then that just sounds very generic and academic, right? So yeah. Wanted something that sounded a little different. Maybe that's why those clubs did it. I would have to look into the history. And there's another Brian Clough reference with Brighton, Hove, and Albion, where he, by the way, did manage, which the Damned United film does not show that. He did manage there for a season.
That's right.
And they took some creative liberty to – right? In the film, they had Taylor manage, and Taylor did take over from him there. Taylor chose not to go to Leeds with him. But they show it as if he never managed there. And, in fact, Clough in his later on in life said Mike Bamber, who we see him shaking hands with and then walking out on essentially in the film, was one of the nicest men and best men he worked for. It was really agonizing to leave Brighton because I had a good chairman, and then mm-hmm. I went to Leeds rights and had what I had, right? Yeah. You know, Mandy Cousins and this kind of, you know, very corporate-ish, results-oriented board. But, yeah, it's funny. I guess this entire podcast has been about Brian Clough in some way.
Well, the name of it is good in terms of the name Albion. I think that's easy to remember. And once that book is finished, being written and then published, it'll be easier to find, that's for sure. So listeners, thank you for listening. You can get a new episode of the podcast every Thursday on every major podcast player, including Spotify, including Google Home, including Alexa, as well as YouTube and worldsoccertalk.com, etc. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media, and we'd really, really appreciate it if you post a review on iTunes. Give us a written review. Let us know how we're doing, if you like us, don't like us, or in between. Any feedback would be great. And last but not least, Kartik, heading into another weekend of uncertainty. What should they do?
Enjoy your tape football.